When a crime is committed, the perpetrator inevitably leaves behind something, a description, DNA, or physical evidence. This is the criminal's print on the scene. Welcome to the Criminal Prints Podcast, Episode 6.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Criminal Prints Podcast, Episode 6. This is Zach.
And I'm Jaron.
Thank you for joining us today. We're glad to have you. Today, we are going to be talking about the disappearance of Brandon Victor Swanson. Brandon Swanson was born January 30th, 1989, in Marshall, Minnesota. And that's in the southwestern Minnesota. Brandon was a very friendly young man who was extremely easy to get along with. He had a lot of friends. According to his mother, Annette, he loved his car and loved to drive. Some physical characteristics about Brandon is he had brown hair, brown eyes, and this will be important a little later in the episode, but he was legally blind in his left eye, and he wore black wired frame glasses. He had a small scar above his left eye and had pierced ears and wore a stud earring, one in each ear.
In 2007, Brandon graduated from Marshall High School. Marshall's a small city in Lyon County, Minnesota. The population as of 2010 was only 13,680. It happens to be the hometown of Schwann Ice Cream.
Can't go wrong with Schwann Ice Cream.
Yeah, I agree with you on that, Zach. So after he graduated high school, he chose to study wind turbines for a year at Minnesota West Community and Technical Campus in Cambie, Minnesota, which wasn't far from home at all, about an hour drive. Brandon was known to be a very hard worker, and he had a job at the Hy-Vee grocery store for 4 full years before his disappearance. Him and his family were very close to each other, and he had made arrangements to transfer to Iowa Western Community College in Council Bluffs, Iowa in August of 2008, and eventually he wanted to enroll in a 4-year university and have a career in sciences.
So the day we're going to be talking about all starts on May 13th, 2008. So Brandon had just completed his first year of college at the Minnesota West Community and Technical College. So he was going to graduate the next day. He was excited. He went to a small party or a gathering of friends at a friend's house in Lind, Minnesota. Because it was a night before graduation, you know, they're having a good time. And he drank at least one beer. The exact amount of alcohol he drank is unknown, but we do know that he at least had one beer at this party. A witness who was at that party said it was just kind of low-key, and when Brandon left, he was not overly intoxicated. So we know between 10:30 and 11 p.m., Brandon left this gathering and drove to another friend's house in Cambie, Minnesota. And that's around a 37-minute drive, about 31 miles. And he wanted to go say goodbye to a classmate, a friend of his. So we know that at this second party, he had an additional shot of whiskey at this party. Again, we don't know the exact amount at this party, but we know for sure at least one shot of whiskey. And this party, he was only there for a short time, and he left sometime after midnight to go home to Marshall, Minnesota.
So now the date is 5/14/2008. We're in the very early hours, just past midnight. And there's a 2-lane highway, it's called Highway 68, that goes directly from Cambie to Marshall. And he was headed home to Marshall, so that's perfect. He was very familiar with the route, and he'd driven it many times. But he decided to not take this route. Instead, he took gravel roads northeast of the highway to get home. Zach, what do you think? Is it possible that the fact that he was underage drinking led him to not take the main highway?
I absolutely believe that was the case. I mean, obviously we can't prove it, but he was underage. He clearly had alcohol in his system. My personal opinion is this was a big part of why he took the side roads.
Yeah, and you got to assume in an area like that that the main roads are patrolled much more heavily, especially in the early morning hours. So the gravel roads and the highway don't run exactly parallel, and it seems like he got lost. He ended up driving west down a maintenance road for a mile, and it was a field between two large crops. He attempted to turn back onto a gravel road, but he missed the field approach, and he got stuck in a ditch. So the ditch bank, apparently it was pretty shallow, but in that area it was pretty steep. So the frame of the car got high-centered. He tried to put it in drive and reverse back and forth, but he was stuck because he was high-centered, so he couldn't get out. He did this all at pretty low speed, so there was no injury or damage to the car or anything like that. And best time estimate at this point is 1:15 a.m.
So once he got stuck, Brandon tried to call multiple friends and ask for their help. But, you know, it's 1:15 in the morning, and so unfortunately none of his friends answered and he couldn't get a hold of them. So at this point, he decided to call his parents. So at 1:54 a.m., he called his parents and asked them for help, and his parents were more than willing to help. He told his parents that he was stuck in a ditch between Marshall and Lind. So he called his parents multiple times between 1:54 a.m. and 2:17 a.m. During one of these calls, he said that he was on the left side of the road, just off Highway 23. Now, we'll get into this a lot more to come, but he was possibly confusing Highway 68 for Highway 23. When his parents arrived at this location and looked for Brandon in his car, they couldn't find him. So I'm just thinking out loud here, but some of the reasons he possibly got lost are, you know, we know he was partially blind in one eye. It was dark. He was tired. It was really early in the morning. He possibly wasn't familiar with the dirt roads, the back roads.
Yeah, and of course the alcohol could have been part of that confusion as well.
Certainly.
And like you said, we don't know how much he drank, just that he was drinking. So at 2:17, his parents arrived and they couldn't find him. They started flashing their car lights to help find each other, both Brandon and them, but they couldn't see any lights. At one point, she said, "We're flashing our lights," and his response to her was, "Don't you see me?" So they got frustrated. He hangs up the phone on his mom. She calls him back and apologizes they were getting frustrated. He tells his mom that he can see Lynn's town lights, and he's going to walk towards them and meet me in this tavern parking lot, and they'll head home from there.
So at 2:23 a.m., this is where the final conversation, the final phone call starts. And he starts talking to his father, Brian, on his cell phone. And Brandon tells his dad he's walking along a gravel road away from Marshall towards Lind. He then tells his father he's going to cut through the fields to make it quicker. So he's just trying to find, I'm sure Jaron would agree, a shortcut to make it less of a walk.
Yeah, and the area, it appears to be very flat and mainly just agricultural area. So you would think, you know, I can just pick the straightest path and it'd be pretty easy, really.
As he's talking to his dad, he's kind of giving him a play-by-play. He tells him he's walking along gravel roads, that he sees two fence lines, and that he can hear running water. So they talk this time for around 47 minutes until something very strange and very unfortunate happens. So 47 minutes into the call, Brian hears Brandon say, "Oh, crap, we'll censor it." But it was clearly a swear word. And Brian said that it sounded like Brandon had tripped and fallen. The time when he said, "Oh, crap," was 3:10 a.m. And at this point, the phone was disconnected. So his dad immediately tried calling Brandon back several times, but the phone would just ring and nobody answered. On a side note, it was the next day when the phone started going straight to voicemail and not ringing.
So I'm going to talk a little bit about the weather on May 14th when he got lost. It was 46 degrees, but it dropped to a low of 39 degrees. If you know Minnesota, you know it can get really, really cold. And this wasn't really, really cold, but it was cold. There was a light wind of 6 to 9 miles an hour. Brandon's parents continued looking through him all night, but they couldn't find him or his car. And at 6:30 a.m., the parents contacted the county sheriff's office to report him missing. And this is kind of a controversial part of the case. The police told him they need to wait a while because it's not unheard of for young men to go offline for a little while. And most people, I think, would agree that this was a little bit different than the normal missing person because they were literally on the phone. They know something happened, but still the police didn't want to follow up on it because it was policy to not follow up on a missing adult for 24 hours. But what they did do is they put a request in for Brandon's cell phone data, and they got this data, and it showed that Brandon was by Porter, Minnesota, and not Lind when he called his parents. While he thought he was by Lind, he was actually about 25 miles away around a city called Taunton.
What a huge difference. Oh my.
Yeah, and for somebody that grew up around there, you know, he was way off course.
Absolutely.
But still, this was a good thing to find because it helped narrow the search area down quite a lot. And because of that, around 12:30 in the afternoon, deputies discovered Brandon's car off in the ditch, like we described, about 1 mile north of Highway 68.
So the county sheriff, Jack Vizitsky, said that Brandon's Chevy Lumina, quote, "It was off the side of a field approach, and the vehicle was hung up. It's sort of a sharp incline, nothing major, but enough that the car would get hung up, so the wheels are too high off the ground to get traction. But as we know from before, there was no physical damage to the car, and there is no evidence of bodily injury to Brandon in the car. There were also no tracks and no way to tell which direction Brandon might have started walking, unfortunately. So on May 15th, it was determined his final call had been routed through a tower at the intersection of County Routes 3 and 10 near Minnesota, another town near Highway 68. So the call had been made within a 5-mile radius of the tower. Another interesting note is from this area, a red light atop a Taunton grain elevator could be seen. So something that came to my mind is, could he have possibly thought the light from this tower was the lights of Lind?
Yeah, and like he had told his dad, hey, I see the town lights, I'm going to head towards there. So that is possible. It's a little unusual that he would think a red light was city lights.
It is.
But he could have thought that it was a sign for a tavern or something of that manner. So they began the big search for him. They had an aerial team. They were doing flyovers. They had search dogs that were brought in from the Twin Cities, which obviously they had a lot more resources. These are very small towns, rural area. They brought in boats to deploy along the river, and they brought in gates to install in the river. And the idea of these gates is it would stop his body in the event that he was floating through the river. These are pretty narrow waterways, but it's very fast-moving water. So, again, you install gates, that way it would stop him. They also brought in horses and all-terrain vehicles. Deputies walked the riverbank looking for any clues. So one thing that did happen was a dog picked up the scent of Brandon, and they were hoping to track his movements, obviously. So the dog went a half a mile south, and then turned onto 390th Street, which was just a street near where his car was found, and it continued for a mile. The trail eventually turned into Road 16, and it continued north for a half mile, then turned west onto a driveway of an abandoned farm. It continued west for approximately another quarter mile, and then left the driveway and roughly followed the course of the Yellow Medicine River heading northwest, which would kind of make sense. He did describe the sound of running water, right?
He certainly did.
And at one point, the bloodhound actually jumped into the river and then jumped back out. The handler interpreted that as, hey, he may have fallen into the river at this point. However, the trail continued past this point to a drainage area, and then went north towards a gravel road forming the boundary between Lincoln and Yellow Medicine counties. And at this point, the dog was unable to follow the scent anymore.
The tracking that we know is interesting because it is consistent with what he told his dad on the phone. He talked about the gravel roads, we know. He also mentioned the two fence lines, which are in this area. So that's interesting. The average person, we know, walks between 1 and 3 miles per hour. So at this pace, it would put Brandon between 3/4 and 2.5 miles away from his car when his phone died. The trail to where the dog jumped into the river, on an interesting note, is within the range of possibly walking at the normal pace. Did the trail continue? We know that even though the dog did jump into the Yellow Medicine River, he jumped out again and continued tracking. So this is fascinating to me because I personally believe it's very possible he fell into the river, but did he make it back out? And we know that bodies, even after drowning, that the gases get released and they start floating. So at some point, you would see the body floating on the water. And we know that Sheriff Vizitsky continued to walk the 2 miles of the Yellow Medicine River every day for 30 days looking for either evidence and or a body. And in this 30 days, he found absolutely nothing. So this is fascinating to me, and this is dedication to the sheriff.
Yeah, you have to admire that. He took his job very seriously. It's a small area, and they take care of their own. And 30 days, 2 miles a day, and kind of the riverbank terrain, that's really cool that he was willing to do that.
I agree. That's awesome.
So formal searches resumed later that fall. And at this point, fields that had been planted shortly after the disappearance had been harvested. Dogs on those searches continued to follow scent of human remains in the area northwest of Porter that wasn't searched before. Unfortunately, no human remains or evidence of them ever came up, and there was also no evidence of what happened to Brandon that night found. But the search continued through 2011 after the snow melted, but before crops were planted. By this time, they had actually searched 122 square miles.
This is crazy because, I mean, for example, the cell phone was a 5-mile radius. It's crazy to me that they expanded it out so far. I mean, they really tried their hardest and did what they could do to try to solve this disappearance.
Yeah, and you have to wonder how much of that 122 miles was just because the high current or the fast current in the river and how far down the river they felt they had to go to find a body.
So this is where we're going to talk a little bit about theories. It's possible, did he fall into the Yellow Medicine River and drowned?
I think that that's probably the most likely scenario here.
I do too, but I do find it extremely intriguing that no body was found.
Yeah, no body was found initially after they gated the river, and no body was found since when it should have been floating.
Did he fall into the river and make it out? And if he did he possibly die from hypothermia?
Yeah, that also seems very possible. But you do wonder, if that's the case, why did they not find his body in all this searching on the land that they did?
Agreed. Completely. Another thought I had when I started looking into this case pretty deeply was, did he possibly cut into the wrong field? For example, was it foul play? Was he shot or injured by possibly the owner of a field? I mean, it was early in the morning. Maybe, you know, it could be a long shot, but possibly the owner could say, hey, who are you and what the heck are you doing in my field?
And it seems very unlikely, but so is drowning or freezing and not being found. So I think it's tough to rule it out. You also wonder, could he have been hit by a car? You would think, though, that there would be blood or some type of evidence. The other option is, could he have staged a disappearance?
I've thought about this one too, but I personally think this is unlikely because he was very dedicated to his family. He was very close to his sister. Family was extremely important to him. And also, we know he was literally talking to his dad, asking for help when his phone cut out.
Yeah, it does seem unlikely if you're staging a disappearance that you would go through the motions to actually talk to your family while it's happening, etc. It seems a little beyond the pale. So a few updates in the case. In 2010, the Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension took over the case and they set up a tip line. By 2015, 90 tips have been received, which isn't a huge number when you consider some cases you can just get flooded with tips in the hundreds or thousands.
Hopefully one of these tips eventually leads to a discovery.
Yeah, hopefully. When the official search resumed in 2015, the area of interest moved towards Mud Creek. That's a tributary of the Yellow Medicine north and northwest of Porter. And on the 10th anniversary of Brandon's disappearance, Yellow Medicine County Sheriff Bill Flatted said, quote, "It's a huge area. If you take that immediate area where the car was, and then the time frame when he was talking on the phone with his parents, who knows what direction he went and how far he traveled." This statement was made in 2018.
This is kind of an interesting statement to me because, in my opinion, this is just saying, hey, we're clueless, unfortunately.
So one good thing did come from this disappearance.
And this is Brandon's Law. In May 2009, Governor Tim Pawlenty signed into law Brandon's Law. And what this is they had it changed, so now it requires Minnesota police to begin an immediate search for missing adults under 21, as well as older adults who are missing under suspicious circumstances. And this is clearly what Brandon's situation was, is a suspicious circumstance.
So hopefully with that law in the future, they will be able to begin searching earlier. And, you know, if he had fallen in and got his way out, maybe they could have saved him before he had froze, or you just never know. So that's a good thing. Actually, when they signed that bill that was named after him in the law, his parents and his sister Jemine were in attendance. So that's really a cool thing. One last thing, I'm going to leave you with tips and contact information. If you happen to know Brandon or you know anything about what happened that night, you can contact the Lincoln County Sheriff's Department. Their phone number is 507-694-1664.
So that is episode 6 of the Criminal Prince podcast. Thank you again for joining us. Please check out our Facebook and our Twitter page. We love our listeners. If you have any suggestions, we're more than happy to hear from you. And everybody have a wonderful day.